shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Tonight I'm going to talk to you about the laws of the kingdom of God. That's a subject which the churches have botched up, maybe more than most things, and nearly everything you were taught in the ordinary churches you can discount as being partly or wholly false on this subject because of the way they've messed it up. The Bible speaks of four kinds of divine law: the commandments, the judgments, the statutes, and the ordinances. And today's ministers, with rare exceptions, have no idea that there's any difference between these at all. The commandments are the major rules of conduct for the responsibility of man to his God. The Ten Commandments in the 20th chapter of Exodus, of course, are the outstanding examples of this. Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, and so forth. And contrary to what a good many of the churches teach, they're still in full effect. Now, the judgments, the use of that word is a bit misleading. Today, we understand judgment to mean the decision of a court after it's heard the case. But as used in the Bible, it is the rules by which a court is to decide the case. In other words, following the rules set up in what your King James Version calls judgments, a court will know how to decide the case. It is used sometimes in the Bible in the modern sense of the decision also, but from the point of view of Bible law, consider it as the rules by which a court decides the case. Now, not all cases. The commandments need no rules of this sort, they're clear enough. But what the Bible classifies as judgments are the cases between man and his fellow man. It includes the laws in regard to property rights, master and servant, and that sort of thing. Now, here's an example in the 21st and 22nd chapters of Exodus. Now, these are the judgments which thou shalt set before them. If thou buy an Hebrew servant, 6 years shall he serve. In the seventh, he shall go out free for nothing. If he came in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he were married, then his wife shall go out with him. Here's another. He that steals a man and sells him, or even if he be found still in his hand, he shall surely be put to death. For kidnapping, no threat of a slap on the wrist, but probation, however. For kidnapping, always the death sentence, even if the victim is rescued. There's another. If a man shall steal an ox or a sheep, and kill it or sell it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox, or 4 sheep for a sheep. If the theft be certainly found in his hand alive, whether it be ox or ass or sheep, he shall restore double. That takes all the fun out of theft, doesn't it? Why do people steal? They steal to make a profit. And if the result of it is that at the very minimum, if you were caught with a stolen article so the owner gets back his original property, you still have to pay him back equal to the value of what you took. And if you disposed of it, then you may have to pay back from 4 to 5 times what you stole. There's no profit. Likewise, there wasn't much thievery under those rules either. Now, if you're wondering how do you enforce that sort of thing, suppose the thief just laughs in your face and says, well, I'm broke. What are you going to do about it? The law had something to do about it. He was simply sold into slavery for enough to make the required restitution. Now, suppose that he would have to pay back $500. He'd be put up on the auction block. Who will bid $500 for a month of this man's services as a slave? He's that sort, nobody could rely on him. Well, who will bid $500 for 3 months of his services? Now, here, this shows you how scientific God's laws are. The man's own attitude determined his punishment. If he was really sorry, anxious to make good, maybe he would be a willing worker. And maybe you would get a bid for $500 for 3 months of his time. If he was sullen and defiant and obviously wasn't going to work except when you stood over him with a bullwhip, it might take 3 years of his time to get a $500 bid. In other words, he made his own punishment as severe as was needed. And the victim of the crime got his reimbursement. Now, the best thing we know how to do, if we find the criminal, usually that doesn't leave him anything to repay the victim with. If we put him in jail, that doesn't repay the victim. It's an expense on the public. And if instead of that, we just put him on probation, why, he goes back to crime the next day. But God's law knew how to handle the situation. You see, the professional sob sisters weren't drawing up God's laws. Now, the third class of these laws, the statutes, these were general rules of conduct for the government of the nation as a whole, for general good order and prosperity. They were of less magnitude than the commandments, but they were the rules for the civilization that separated the people of Israel from all the other nations. Living according to these statutes, the nation Israel was to give a demonstration of what prosperity and peace and good order can come from living under the rules of the laws of God. They covered the dietary laws, the agricultural laws, the social and financial laws. For example, Leviticus 3, verse 17. It shall be a perpetual statute for your generations throughout all your dwellings that ye eat neither fat nor blood. It took us 3,500 years plus the doctor's bill to find out that the animal fats are the heaviest in cholesterol, which builds up in your arteries, leading to hardening of the arteries and heart attacks. And if you cut out the animal fats, get the necessary fats and oils for your diet from vegetable oils, which are, as they say, primarily unsaturated fatty acids, you get whatever benefit there is from the oil or fat, but without the bad part of it. Only Moses didn't charge anybody a fee as a doctor for giving him this advice. As to the eating of blood, dietitians know that there are a number of very unfavorable factors there, certain diseases that are transmitted through eating of blood, besides other unwholesome chemical factors in blood as a food. This, as you see, wasn't intended for your salvation or for your benefit in heaven afterward. If you didn't eat animal fats, it wasn't in heaven that you had a good, healthy heart. It was here in this life. Here's another, Leviticus 10, verses 8 to 11. And Yahweh spoke unto Aaron, Moses' brother, the high priest, saying, Do not drink wine nor strong drink, thou nor thy sons with thee, when ye go into the tabernacle of the congregation, lest ye die. It shall be a statute forever throughout all your generations, and that ye may put the difference between the holy and the unholy, between the clean and the unclean, and that ye may teach the children of Israel all the statutes which Yahweh has spoken unto them by the hand of Moses. There were to be no drunken priests on duty. Now the Bible did not forbid the priests to drink beer or wine. It's simply that when they were to be on duty as such, they were to be clear-headed. No drinking then. Now, their duties, of course, included not only service in the temple, offering the sacrifices, but also the instruction of the people in the laws of God. And there was to be no thick-headed, drunken stumble-bum doing the instructing. Now, the fourth class, the ordinances, were the rules which governed the religious rituals, the ceremonies, the religious holidays, and so on. Note now that this is a distinct, separate class. It has nothing to do with the general conduct of the people or the nation. These are strictly religious laws. For example, in speaking of the Passover, Exodus 12, verses 42 to 45, it is a night to be much observed unto Yahweh for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is that night of Yahweh to be observed of all the children of Israel in their generations. And Yahweh said unto Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. There shall no stranger eat thereof. The Passover was something between God and his people Israel. Every man's servant that is bought for money, when thou hast circumcised him, then shall he eat thereof. But a foreigner or a hired servant shall not eat thereof. Definitely that was between the Israelite and his God. Now, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, Exodus 13, verses 5 to 10. And it shall be, when Yahweh shall bring thee into the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, which he swore unto thy fathers to give thee, a land flowing with milk and honey, that thou shalt keep this service in this month. 7 days shalt thou eat unleavened bread, and in the seventh day shall be a feast unto Yahweh. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and there shall be no leavened bread be seen with thee, neither shall there be leaven seen with thee in thy quarters. And thou shalt show thy son in that day, saying, this is done because of that which Yahweh did unto me when I came forth out of Egypt. And it shall be for a sign unto thee upon thine hand, and for a memorial between thine eyes, that Yahweh's law may be in thy mouth. For with a strong hand hath Yahweh brought thee out of Egypt. Thou shalt therefore keep this ordinance in his season from year to year. Now, I suppose all of you know, in a general way, how most of our American law originated. We started with the common law of England, and that was not in the form of statutes passed by Parliament, but it was the fact that the recognized customs of the people had been recognized as having the force of law by the courts. And since they kept a record of all the major cases that were decided, you had, therefore, the record of the British courts setting up what was called the common law. Now, gradually, even in England, that was modified and added to by statutes adopted by Parliament. And over here, while we started with the basis of the English common law, the bulk of our law now is statutory. A number of the states, California among them, have tried to organize the law so that all statutes pertaining to a particular subject are found grouped together. You have, for example, your motor vehicle code, and you have civil code of general regulations. You've got the code of civil procedure to govern the courts. You even have a separate evidence code, the rules of evidence to be received in court and so on. Now, when Moses was given the law on Mount Sinai, it wasn't the origin of divine law, but it was what you might call a codifying of the law, reducing it to a systematic statement. The Bible recognizes that God's law was, to some extent, known earlier than that. Genesis 2, verses 16 and 17 records the first commandment. And Yahweh God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die. In Genesis 26, verses 3 to 5, God says this to Isaac, sojourn in this land, and I will be with thee and will bless thee. For unto thee and unto thy seed I will give all these countries, and I will perform the oath which I swore unto Abraham thy father, because, now note this, because that Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments my statutes and my laws. So it shows that there was a good deal of divine law known before the time of Moses, although quite obviously not as well organized. Now you know how, almost without exception, our so-called churches teach, well, now you're not under law, you're under grace. The law is all done away with. It's interesting to ask one of these ministers, now, you mean that? The law is all done away with. Oh, yes, yes, surely. Well, now, by that you mean that I am perfectly free, so far as divine law is concerned, I am perfectly free to commit as many murders and thefts and adulteries as I want to? Because if all the law is done away with, that was part of it. And then watch your minister stammer around and try to figure out what he does mean, if anything. The trouble goes back to how they're instructed in the seminaries. They are taught these are your church doctrines. Now, if you are asked for something to support it, you can find a few words here and there in the Bible that can be given the appearance of supporting it. Why, you ought to be able to talk half an hour on any comma or semicolon in the book. They are not taught the Bible systematically because church doctrine takes first place. The Bible tags along a poor second. Now, what they base their mistake on, there are two places in the New Testament where Paul and even Peter comments on how Paul's writings are so often difficult to understand that they made a lot of trouble even in those days, as they do now. Paul, in two places, said that Christ had done away with the ordinances, nailing them to his cross and so on. Here are the two, and you note that they do not say that the law is done away with, only that portion of the law contained in the ordinances, the rituals, the ceremonies. Ephesians 2, verses 14 and 15. For he is our peace, who hath made both one, and hath broken down the middle wall of partition between us, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of, now note this, commandments contained in ordinances, for to make in himself of twain one new man, so making peace, only those commands that were in the ordinances. Colossians 2, verses 13 to 14. And you, being dead in your sins and the uncircumcision of your flesh, hath he quickened together with him, having forgiven you all your trespasses, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. Now, when you limit Paul to what he actually said and not to the large amount of territory some of the ministers want to take in on this thing, Paul is right. All these ordinances were symbolic of Jesus Christ, what he was going to do, what he was going to accomplish for us. They were to keep alive the memory, the understanding, the hope until he came. And after he had come and performed these things, then you were supposed to put your attention to the reality and not the mere symbol. The ordinance of the Passover, for example, that by the death of the Passover lamb, his blood being shed and put on your front door, public proclamation of your faith, by that you would be spared from death. Well, obviously that's symbolic of Christ. And in the book of Hebrews, the symbolism is explained. Now, we don't go through the old ritual of the Passover. In the Old Testament, in giving the Passover, it says this is to be an ordinance for eternity. Now, we no longer kill a lamb and put its blood on the outside of the front door as they did then. Not because we are neglecting it, but because we have a different form of it. By the old Passover, you proclaimed your faith that at some time in the indefinite future, the Messiah, who had not yet come, would come and make the real sacrifice for you, that by the shedding of his blood, your sins would be forgiven, and the death penalty which your sins had earned would not have to be paid by you because it had been paid for you. Now, after he had come and offered his life on the cross, we can't go through the old ritual of saying, well, The one we're waiting for hasn't come yet. It's still in the future. That would be a rejection of Christ. So the form of the ceremony has been changed, and we have the communion, the Lord's Supper, today, with the bread substituted for the flesh of the lamb, the wine substituted for the blood. Yet still, you have the essential meaning of the Passover. Now, it didn't take long for the symbolic meaning of all these ordinances to be completely lost. It's the sort of thing you would naturally expect when you set up a professional priesthood with rituals to go through. When they can give them the air of a certain amount of magic hocus-pocus. Now, you poor dumb layman, you don't understand this, and you couldn't do any of this yourself. But now, if you come to me, you can pay me well and have me perform the magic ceremony that you can't understand, why then I can get you the benefit of it. And when you want to put that over, when you want to increase your influence and importance and so on, the only way you can do it is to cause the general laity to forget what the meaning of this is and make a mystery out of it. And they speedily did so. The history of organized religion has never been anything but the history of organized corruption. For that reason, you look over the books in your Bible. Now, aside from the merely historic ones, Ezra, Nehemiah, Kings, and Chronicles, you will find some history in some of the others too, but those could have been written by any well-informed agnostic or atheist. They are not stating doc, they are recording what happened. But you turn to those which contain, thus saith Yahweh. You will find that with the two exceptions of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, when God needed a man to go out and say, thus saith Yahweh, he had to go outside of the priesthood to find him. So, you find today the churches teaching their people that the law is all done away with. Go to a church social supper, what do you have almost invariably? Big can. You are supposed, of course, to violate the laws of God in order to show that you're under grace. Jesus Christ had some rather critical comments to make on that, you know. It is true that if a man lived up to all of the law, the moral law as well as the merely practical parts of it, like the dietary law, the agricultural law, financial laws, it would take an awful lot of ingenuity to figure out how to commit a sin without violating some of the laws of God. But that wasn't the real object of the thing. It's very true that Leviticus 18, verses 3 to 5 says, after the doings of the land of Egypt, wherein ye dwelt, shall ye not do. And after the doings of the land of Canaan, whither I bring you, shall ye not do. Neither shall ye walk in their ordinances. Ye shall do my judgments, and keep mine ordinances to walk therein. I am Yahweh your God. Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which, if a man do, he shall live. Now, of course, the great bulk of the law had nothing to do with these moral phases of it. The dietary law had pointed out which foods were wholesome, good for you, which were unwholesome and bad for your health. If you ate unwholesome food, you weren't going to have a stomach ache in heaven after you die. You'd get your ill health here in this life. If you violated the dietary laws, you weren't going to have poor crops in heaven later. You'd have poor crops here and now on this earth. And those things are every bit as true as they ever were. You weren't forfeiting your chance at salvation if you were foolish enough to violate the dietary laws. That wasn't the object of it. Here is what Jesus Christ said in the 5th chapter of Matthew, beginning verse 17. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law until all be fulfilled. Now, when do heaven and earth pass away? Well, it's not until after the millennium, the thousand-year reign of Christ. Revelation 21, verse 1 is the first time where you find a statement that the first heaven and the first earth have passed away. Not only all the time from Christ's lifetime down to now, but at least the next 1,000 years to come, the law is in effect. So he goes on saying this, "Whosoever therefore shall break one of the least of these commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do them and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." So the laws of God are still in effect. Now, nobody ever succeeded in living up to them fully. And in the Old Testament, when you realized you had broken one of these laws, you took your animal sacrifice to the temple and were assured of God's forgiveness. And today, you don't offer an animal sacrifice. You pray to be forgiven because the real sacrifice was made for you by Jesus Christ. But just the same, these ministers who teach the law is all done away with and has no power today, you can see where they're going to wind up even if they get their salvation. In fact, in Proverbs 28, verse 9, "He that turns away his ear from hearing the law, even his prayer shall be an abomination." So much for the general four categories of the law. Now let's take a little look at what they are in some of these groups. The law of military training and military service. There's no pacifism whatever in the Bible. God not only authorized war, he expressly commanded it in certain instances. For example, God commanded the literal extermination of the Amalekites. Exodus 17, verses 14 to 16. And see also Deuteronomy 25, verses 17 and following. "And Yahweh said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in the book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar, and called the name of it Yahweh Nissi, Yahweh is my banner. For, he said, because Yahweh hath sworn that Yahweh will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." Now, the Canaanites who lived in the land that the people of Israel were to occupy, they were commanded to be exterminated. Not that we should simply, like we're doing in Vietnam, say, oh, we don't want to win the war, we just want to make them reasonable. Listen to this. Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 to 4. "When Yahweh thy God shall bring thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, and shall cast out many nations before thee, the Hittites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than thou. And when Yahweh thy God shall deliver them before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. For they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of Yahweh be kindled against you, and destroy thee suddenly." Now, wars of liberation to drive out oppressive tyrants were favored. Numbers 10, verse 9. "And if ye go to war in your land against the enemy that oppresses you, then ye shall blow an alarm with the trumpets, and ye shall be remembered before Yahweh your God, and ye shall be saved from your enemy." And these aggressors who made war against our people were not to be left in condition to keep on repeating it over and over again. Here's Deuteronomy 20, verses 10 to 13. Now, the people had been warned they were not themselves to be aggressors attacking others who were peacefully inclined toward them. But if any other nation made aggressive war on them, here was the rule. "When thou comest nigh unto a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it, and it shall be if it make thee answer of peace and open its gates unto thee, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be tributaries unto thee, and they shall serve thee. And as it will make no peace with thee, but will make war against thee, then thou shalt besiege it. And when Yahweh thy God hath delivered it into thine hands, thou shalt smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword. Exodus 15, verse 3. Yahweh is a man of war. Psalm 144, verse 1. Blessed be Yahweh my strength, which teacheth my hands to war and my fingers to fight. One of the Psalms of David, you know, and you remember that David is the only man of whom God said, this is a man after my own heart. Has Christianity done away with all this sort of thing? Has it revealed that everything that God said before that time was a mistake that has to be thrown out? No, of course not. Jesus Christ confirmed all this. Luke 12, verse 51. Suppose ye that I am come to give peace on earth? I tell you, nay, but rather division. Mix us all up with our enemies in the United Nations in one great happy satanic family? No. Division. Separation. Come out from among them and be ye separate. Luke 22, verse 36. Jesus speaking to his disciples. Then said he unto them, but now, he that hath the purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip. And he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. Matthew 10, verse 34. Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. You cannot have real Christianity, uncompromising resistance to satanic evil, without war, because the satanic organization of the earth isn't going to let you get away with it without war. You've got to do one of two things. You've got to either desert your God and join Satan's forces, or you've got to stand by your God and have war with Satan's, one or the other. There's no intermediate ground. But the Bible makes it very clear that God is not a pacifist in the sense of today's pacifists at all. Now, does that mean that God doesn't like peace? No, not at all. He wants a true peace, which can only be had under his own rule. In Leviticus 26, God says this, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid, and I will rid evil beasts out of the land. Neither shall the sword go through your land. And you shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword. And five of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. Instead of which we turn our back on God in order to get the votes of minority groups. It's hard to find anything in which we have not perverted the laws of God. Now take, for example, the laws of citizenship and eligibility for public office. Anybody from a country whose people are not of our race, whose civilization is not of our sort, whose ideals are not like ours at all, can come in here and after a relatively brief period be naturalized and given full citizenship, equal to someone born here. Now, that's completely contrary to God's law. Under God's law, you'll find it in Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 to 8, those who are of the same race as ours, but not of Israel. Remember now that there were descendants of Abraham by a number of sons, only one of whom was Isaac. Those who are racially the same, although not of our Israel nations, they were not permitted citizenship until the third generation born in the land. By that time, they could have pretty well absorbed our way of looking on things. But as to those who were racially not the same, they could not be admitted to citizenship even to the tenth generation. Were not permitted to hold any public office. Anyone of non-Israel blood who is not thy brother. Deuteronomy 17, verse 15. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. Now, that word stranger doesn't mean somebody to whom you have not been formally introduced. It's the Hebrew word nokri, which means a person of a different race. When any non-Israelite is able to gain public office, that is plainly stated in the Bible as being a curse upon us and a punishment for our wickedness. Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 and 43 to 45. But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of Yahweh thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, that these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Then he goes on to list a number of them, and you come to this. The stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low. He shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail, because thou hearkenest not unto the voice of Yahweh thy God, to keep his commandments and his statutes, which he commanded thee. So the very fact that you can have this Negro shows to what an extent we have sunk in the eyes of God. Now you notice that this is something that is always promoted by those who like to call themselves liberal. And that also is taken up in the Bible. In the 32nd chapter of Isaiah, he starts out talking about what it's going to be like in the kingdom of God. And in Isaiah 32, verse 5, he says that then the vile, V-I-L-E, the vile person shall no more be called liberal. Now it's the foreign policy. You hear stupid people always parroting, oh, you must love your enemies. You remember the Bible is very careful to say your enemy and to distinguish between your enemy and God's enemy. If your fellow Israelite is your enemy, he's your enemy for one of two reasons. Either you actually have done something wrong to him, in which case you should make amends, or he mistakenly thinks you have done something wrong to him, in which case you should try to get him to understand that you didn't do it. But now God's enemy is a very different thing. You remember that on the breakup of Israel, on the death of Solomon, the northern kingdom went into idolatry immediately. And, of course, God naturally took away his favor from the northern kingdom of Israel on that account. A little while after that, one of the kings of Judah sent military aid to help the king of Israel in some battle or other. And he was given this rebuke, "Shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? Therefore is wrath upon thee from before the Lord." When you help God's enemies, when you range yourself on their side, you yourself become the enemy of God and can expect to pay the penalty accordingly. And parroting, love your enemy, isn't going to change the facts a bit. You don't fool God with catchphrases. In Psalm 139, King David says this, "Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? Am not I grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with a perfect hatred. I count them mine enemy." Now, did God look down his nose at David and say, "Oh, well, you're one of those awful hate mongers"? No. Two places in the Bible, Acts 13, verse 22, 1 Samuel 13, verse 14, you find God said this, "I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after mine own heart." If any of us could get that much approval, it would be something. Now, as to the economic laws governing business. Of course, the strictest of honesty was required. No false measures, no false weights. You'll find that in Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 to 16, Leviticus 19, verses 35 to 36. On loans, no interest whatever could be charged except from aliens. To your fellow Israelite, you could not charge any interest. Today, we say, well, usury, that's anything above 42% a year. As the word usury is used in your King James Version, It means a trillionth, a 1%, a century, or anything above it. Anything whatsoever, anything that is paid for the use of money or a thing of value, is usury in that sense. In other words, the lender must pay back to you the principal of what he borrowed, but not interest. Now, you are under no obligation to try to make the people of other races as prosperous as Israel. If they wanted to borrow from you to get some of your prosperity, it was fair enough that they pay you something for it. And you could charge interest to any non-Israelite. See Deuteronomy 23, verses 19 to 20, Leviticus 25, verses 35 to 38. Now, they had mortgages in those days, and if a person became hard up and had to mortgage the family homestead, the farm, or had to sell it, he had the right of redemption. In other words, you could not lose the farm that was the source of the family's living permanently. Now, a house within a walled city was in a little different classification. If you sold a house within a walled city, you had 1 year in which to redeem it. And if you didn't redeem it within a year, it was gone permanently. But the people within the city were not depending on that house primarily for their living. If you were a saddle maker or a silversmith or whatnot, living in town doing your work, you could move to another house someplace else and do your work just as well. But as to the farm, which was the source of the family's living, every 50th year, the Jubilee year, whatever property had been sold or taken on mortgage foreclosure, if it had not been redeemed before that, it came back to its original owner without the payment of anything. That doesn't mean 50 years from the time you sold it. It was every 50th year on the calendar. If last year was the Jubilee year, you could mortgage or sell your property this year for 50 years. If next year was the Jubilee year, you could only mortgage or sell it for the remainder of this year. When that time came, the property came back without payment of anything. You remember what happened to the Roman Empire. When they were a nation of sturdy, independent farmers, they became a powerful empire that ruled most of the known world. Then the inevitable happened. Farmers, of course, are subject to the vagaries of bad weather and insect plagues and that sort of thing. They have a bad year, get no crop, and the average farmer doesn't have enough saved up to coast over another year. So they mortgage the farm and lose it in foreclosure, or they have to sell it. They drift into town to become a landless city rabble, and there you have the fall of the Roman Empire, as you can find it in great detail in Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. That was not to happen to God's people, Israel. Every seventh year, the year of release, you were freed from the burden of unpayable debt. Now, it was the obligation of every man who was in debt to make every honest effort to pay off his debt. But it was bound to happen to many that, with all honesty and good faith, they just couldn't do it. Now, instead of being hounded forever, you know how it is today, a man owes some money, the creditor won't wait, he gets a judgment, then he levies an attachment on the man's wages, garnishment on his wages, and gets him fired from his job. And whenever he gets a new job, well, the creditor's around there to levy a garnishment on the wages and gets him fired from that job. That sort of thing couldn't be under the rules of the kingdom of God. Whatever remained unpaid after all fair and honest efforts were made to pay it, when the seventh year came around, was canceled. You got a fresh start. Now, God promised that if the nation would live up to that, the creditors would recognize the release of debt on the seventh year, that God would send such prosperity that you would not suffer any loss from not continuing to extract every penny from your debtors. Then, as I say, after seven of these year of release periods, you came to the Jubilee year. Now, where you had sold your property or lost it in foreclosure, no further proceedings could be taken to try to collect a deficiency judgment after that seventh year, but the property didn't automatically go back to you on the seventh year. It was only on the Jubilee year. In the agricultural laws, you had the rules which we violate constantly and pay the penalty. One of these rules was this, that when you plant trees, you cannot wait eagerly to grab the first apple or orange or what have you that the tree can produce. For the first 3 years, you are not permitted to allow any fruit to form on the tree at all. You've got to go around and nip off every bud so that no fruit forms. The fourth year, if you wish, you are permitted to let fruit form on the tree, but none of it's for you. Every single bit of it has to be taken to the temple as an offering. The fifth year's crop and thereafter is your own. Well, now, I had a chance to see that demonstrated. A friend of mine planted it in an orange grove, and the very same year, his land and his next-door neighbors, on the same slope of the same hill, the same exposure to sunlight and the weather, the same soil, no difference except a wire fence separating the two properties. His neighbor also planted an orange grove at the very same time. And I was out there and I looked them over when the fifth year's crop was forming on the trees. On the neighbor's land, the trees were not particularly big. There was a certain amount of height, but the branches were thin and spindly. There were some oranges on it, not a great many. And under every one of these little thin, spindly branches, there was a wooden prop so that the branch wouldn't be broken by the weight of these oranges. Now, my friend had obeyed God's law. For 4 years, no fruit was allowed to form, and here was his first crop, the fifth year, forming on the tree. His trees were pretty nearly double the size of his neighbor's. His crop was considerably more than double the number of oranges, and there wasn't a prop under one of these branches, and there wasn't one needed. At the end of that fifth year, my friend would have more saleable crops than his neighbor had for the entire five, and from then on, pure velvet, because his trees were always going to be that much better than his neighbor. Now, God doesn't bother arguing with you why you should do these things. He tells you this is the best way, do it. If you're curious enough to look into it, you'll find out there's a good reason for it. Now, another one of these agricultural laws is that your land must get its Sabbath of rest. 1 year in seven, the land must be allowed to lie fallow. You plant and harvest your crops for 6 years, and the next year you let it alone. Now, you remember the Dust Bowl conditions of around 1932-3 in there. We followed our customary greed. We were constantly planting and replanting the land. And you know, in the Bible it says that if you do not follow these agricultural laws, God said, I will make the sky like brass, and your rain shall be powder and dust. Why the 1 year rest in seven? A plant has to get out of the soil two things. It has to get the nitrogen-bearing remains the former plant lies there, and it has to get minerals. You eat plants growing on worn-out soil, and they are lacking in vitamins, and especially they are lacking in minerals because they can't get them out of a worn-out soil. A grain of sand is all mineral, and it isn't of any use to the plant because that quartz is completely insoluble in water, and the plant can't get anything but what dissolves in water. Now, there are bacteria that grow in the soil in great numbers, and as a byproduct of their existence, they produce certain acids, and these acids corrode away the surface of the sand grains, breaking them down into water-soluble salt. And therefore, those dissolve in the water, the roots of the plants draw the water out of the ground, and they get the mineral for a healthy plant. Now, you can pour on ammonium sulfate fertilizers on the land, and sure, it's sort of a shot in the arm to the plant. It makes it green, the same way green paint would, but it doesn't make it healthy. You've got to have those soluble minerals. At the end of 6 years, you have, as you might say, overdrawn your bank account of soluble minerals in the soil. Whatever reserve was there, you've used up, and you're taking it out faster than the bacteria can replace it. Now, if you will let it alone the seventh year, not grow anything, the bacteria continue working, and you've got one whole year's production of soluble mineral salts there, ready to start out with. Your bank account is replenished with a new deposit. So the eighth year, when you plant your crop, they've got one whole year's production in addition to the current year's production. They use all of the current year's production, and they draw a little bit on the 1 year's reserve that's there. And that will carry you through for 6 years. Then you start out with another year of rest. A few years ago, I saw some figures put out by someone who unquestionably knew nothing about divine law on this, but he was just recording what the statistics showed. The agriculture department knew, of course, exactly what the yield had been per acre on those dust bowl areas when they were planted to wheat, before the dust storm finally compelled giving the land its rest. Well, they had to leave them several years fallow, and finally they began cautiously planting some of them. And he reported this. The first year's crop they took off after the several years' rest, the yield was as high as 400% what it had been before the dust storm period started. Now, let's see what you can do by violating the laws of God. For most of our prairie states of the Midwest, we have pretty exact statistics on what the yield per acre of wheat and corn and so on has been from the time they were first put under cultivation. And you do not get as high production per acre now as you did 75 to 100 years ago. But let's assume that you got a steady level of production. A year's crop, we'll say, is one unit. You get one unit for each of 8 years. That's 8 units. Now suppose you follow the law of God. You get one unit for each of the first 6. Then you skip the 7th, getting nothing. And on the 8th, you get 4 units. 6 and 4 are 10, as compared to 8 if you didn't give the land its rest. We think we're too smart when we're merely too greedy to follow God's laws. But there's a good reason for all of God's laws. And if you follow them, they pay off. As to the dietary laws, I read you the one, Deuteronomy 12, verses 23 to 25, that you are not to eat fat of the meat, nor blood. Another rule is that you are not to eat any kind of contaminated meat, meat that has been in contact with things that might put some sort of bacterial infection into it. Now, as to what meats are fit to eat, they were given the rule, you could eat the flesh of those animals which both had a cloven hoof and chew the cud. Now, a rabbit chews the cud, but it has paws and not hoofs at all. A pig has cloven hoofs, but it does not chew the cud. Pork, rabbit, forbidden. Cattle, cloven hoof. Sheep, cloven hoof. Deer, cloven hoof. They also have a double stomach and chew the cud. Why shouldn't you eat any of these other things? Are the rules arbitrary? No. You can disregard God's law, eat pork, and get trichinosis. There are hundreds of thousands of cases of it every year in the United States. Much of it not diagnosed. You see, these are tiny little worms. They're very small, almost microscopically small. And they work themselves all through the muscles of the meat, chew out a little hollow where they settle down, and the body sort of walls it in with a membrane around it. And there they stay. They're thriving on the nourishment carried to them by the blood. You eat the meat of an infected pig. In your stomach, the meat digests. And that means these sacs around these little worms digest, setting them free. They burrow through the walls of your intestines into the blood vessels there. And they drift with the blood throughout your body, and wherever the idea occurs to them, they decide this is far enough. They burrow through the wall of the blood vessel into the muscles, and and set up housekeeping. Now, if some of them do this in the liver, you have jaundice and maybe suspected as a case of cirrhosis of the liver. And without an autopsy cutting up your liver to see, they can't know whether it's trichinosis or not. So many of these are not diagnosed. Even if you cook pork well enough that you kill all the trichinosis worms in the thing, that doesn't make it a wholesome food. There's too much else wrong with it. Remember that what it has done to the flesh of that diseased animal, the chemical condition that is set up there, which is causing the sickness of the animal, that's what you're taking into your body. Any kind of fish with fins and scales. Catfish has fins, but it has no scales. And the catfish is a carrion eater. It eats dead and rotting things that it finds in the water. Now, among the birds, there's a long list of forbidden birds. Of course, the vulture and buzzard and so on, carrion eaters, are forbidden. But also, in general, the carnivorous birds, the eagle, the hawk, and so on, are forbidden. As among the four-footed animals, all the carnivorous animals are forbidden. These things are unwholesome. Eat no flesh of any animal that has died of disease. Now, if you go out into the field and find the carcass of a cow that died of hoof and mouth disease, and you cut a steak off of it and take it home and eat it, you probably are not going to lose your salvation. In fact, you may wind up in heaven a lot quicker. You're going to lose your health immediately and quite probably your life. So, the whole purpose of these laws of the practical group, it does not deal with your spiritual salvation. It deals with your practical life here and now. Why then did God do more than just make suggestions? Well, he said in substance, I want a healthy nation to serve me. Don't defile yourself with these things when you are going to be my people, my demonstration of what a nation should be. I have said that if you will obey my laws, you will have good health, long life, peace, prosperity. Now, don't you go spoiling the demonstration by making yourself sick, violating the very laws that I have given you for your guidance. God wanted this nation to have a chance to show the world what obedience to his law would do. Anytime we're ready to get back on the ball and live up to the laws of God, we can get all the benefits of it.
You have been listening to a message by the late Pastor Bertrandale Compre from his sermon titled The Laws of God. If you would like a complete CD of this talk, ask for it by name and send a donation to cover our costs and help with radio time. Thank you.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.